Hi, this is Chuck Shelton from Albemarle Cider Works in North Garden, Virginia, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode number 56. Hello, and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincaller, and I am your Cider MC on this weekly podcast where we speak with cider makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, it's Chuck Shelton from Albemarle Cider Works. There'll be more on that chat in a moment. Support Cider Chat today when you next go online into Amazon. Click on any of the books at the ciderchat.com/resource page, where there are a whole bunch of Apple books that you could choose from, and that'll take you into the Amazon portal. You could either buy one of those books for yourself, for a friend, or a loved one, and at the same time support Cider Chat. I am an affiliate of the Amazon program, and though I won't know what you're buying, each item that you do buy, a little cut goes to Cider Chat, which is a fun roundabout way to help keep this chat thriving. Just go to ciderchat.com/resources. In Ciderville, every week is a busy week, and this week is no different. There's lots of things going on, and specifically online too. Lots of folks have been joining the Cider Chat Facebook page, so thank you for that. And I'm going to be posting some fun photos coming up. I'll chat about that in just a moment. But let's give a little shout out to Tim, who is a friend of Jamie McGee. So cool for that. Welcome, Tim. And then we have Yukitaka from Japan, who I see is full on into cider. So that's really cool. A lot of friend connections happening in Japan. I am so, so thrilled for that. And then there's Jake. And then there is Michael from San Diego. I'll be heading out to California coming up in December. I'm hoping to get a little bit of cider on there. I have a bit of family responsibility I have to do out there, so I am blending, pun intended, both the apples in my family and the apples out in the world. So I'll be updating you with that. But I'm heading into San Francisco, and then I'll be going down the coast, bopping into all my family out there, and then flying out of San Diego. So I do hope to catch up with some cider folks there. And if you're listening to this now and you'd like to have a little bit of a cider meetup, well, I am into that. And just send me a line, Rhea@ciderchat.com, or give me a shout out on Twitter @ciderchat. All right, there's also Joshua, and then Brian from Indiana. And hello to Matthew, and hello to Bruce, and then to Eric from Illinois. And then we have one more person, who is Todd. And Todd, I see your profile photo is a Marine, so thank you for your service. My brother was a Marine, and yep, actually even a number. You know, I have a lot of friends who are Marines. Oh, we have lots of friends in Ciderville. All good people indeed. And all these folks who have come on board, well, we know that you are in the Apple way and perhaps the Pear way too. So it's all good. And welcome to the Facebook page. Do know that this is non-exclusive. And you, dear Ciderville, are more than welcome to join in on the fun. In the last episode, which is episode number 55, and that was with David Gott singing Apple Songs, I also spoke about an apple that I pressed just last week. And there's actually a video of that at the Cider Chat YouTube channel. It's called Real Cider Makers Pick Their Own Apples. Oh, I'm sure I'm going to have lots of conversations about that. Anywho, I was out in the orchard picking this one beautiful tree, which is called a lady. It's a very small apple, and lucky for me, I was scheduled to kind of go into the cider mill and press that about 2 weeks earlier. But things happened, and I was kind of busy, and I caught a little cold, and I just couldn't do it. So it turned out that I was able to get out to that apple orchard on November 13th, which now I could credit as being my lucky number. Because as it goes with apples, sometimes you might be ready, but the apple tree is not. And that 2-week difference, well, that saved me what I think a mediocre cider into what I believe is going to be just one heck of a delicious cider. I'm making a single variety cider this time around, and out of that tree, I was only really able to get 2 bushels of apples. Now, that's not too much. That's essentially 2 apple boxes filled. Mind you, when I went out 2 weeks later and I bit into that little apple and was tasting it, what a difference 2 weeks had made. It was finally at the stage where I really felt the sweetness had come out, the astringency was right on, and that sucker was ready to press. So into the cider mill it went, and I had the opportunity to do a little bit of maceration. Now, if you haven't heard this term before, what that means is to sweat the apples. Sometimes folks do that by just leaving kind of overripe apples out. But more often than not, maceration means where you grind up the apples and you now have what is called pomace. So ground up apples equals pomace, and that's P-O-M-A-C-E. And what happens there is you want to have some contact with oxygen. And by doing that, you're helping to kind of brown the apples a little bit because, you know, if you slice into any apple and leave it out on the counter, for the most part, it starts to brown a little bit. And it starts working on the pectin, which I believe also gave me a greater yield had I not left it to macerate. What I mean by that is if we had just ground up the apples and then went right into the press, I do not think I would have gotten as much fresh pressed juice. So what happened is it sat out there for about 5 hours and macerated. And don't you know, when the pomace was finally put into the press, not until like the very, like, the press was kind of going along, but right at like this critical moment into the press, it was kind of going down, all of a sudden the juice started coming out. And that is because I believe the apple is kind of breaking down a little bit. I mean, it's not really rocket science, right? You have an apple in your hand and it starts kind of like gooing up a bit. It just gets easier to squish. And if you have it really fresh and it's, you know, all kind of bonded together, holding tight without being too scientific, it's going to be harder to press that. So by letting it get a little bit squishy, I believe I got a larger yield. That came out, and the orchard folks, they were surprised because they had never pressed this apple before. And in some ways, I'm a little bummed out that they know it now. Although, you know, like as I speak in this chat this week with Chuck Shelton, the interesting thing is a lot of single variety ciders actually are not just a single variety, that there's a base cider too. There'll be more about that in this upcoming chat with Chuck on this episode, so just stay tuned for that. But just to finish off with this lady, you got to wait a little bit. And the thing about apple trees and pressing and making cider, it's really on the apple's time, not our time. And that's what makes it kind of a little bit of a persnickety thing to do. And a lot of cider makers I talk to on past episodes will say the same thing. You know, this is not easy work because you really have to work with the land. And if you don't have a good sense of that and you don't have a good sense of what's happening out in the orchard, you won't really get that optimal time. And that's what I think is a big difference between an orchard-based cidery and a cidery that is shipping in juice. If you're not out in the orchard tasting and really dipping into that and getting to know the tree and knowing the timetable, then a lot can go wrong, or not necessarily go wrong, which might be too harsh of a word, but you're not necessarily getting the optimal moment when the apple is ready to be pressed. I think I got it. I'm really excited about it. And we'll be staying tuned on more updates on this lady cider that I made. I only got about 2 3/4, so I had to top off a little bit in my carboy because I didn't want to have any oxygen in that vessel then once the juice is pressed and ready to ferment. And I did pitch a yeast, so it's not a full wild fermentation. I just pitched a dry yeast, a basic one that could kind of do a low temperature fermentation. And what I mean by that, about 60 degrees, I'm going to keep it steady on. It is in my basement on the cellar floor, which is nice and cool. And we'll just let it have it. We'll just let it go along and make itself. So much fun. I hope you're making cider. And if you are, please share that on our Facebook page or send me a line, Rhea@ciderchat.com. Speaking of which, I did get a really fun email from a listener. And this gentleman, his name is Jim, and I've talked about it in the past, but we're just going to start from the beginning right here. He and his family have bought a farm down south, and he just heard the podcast with Mike Schilling on wild cider and yeast, and that's where you do not pitch a yeast culture, you just let the cider go wild. And don't you know that he's doing what they call a natural yeast capture program. They're doing that on his farm, and they're doing it in partnership with Wildflower, an all wild yeast brewery in Australia that's owned by Jim's brother. It's just wonderful. And we're going to be following along with that. So he did send me some photos, which I'll put up on the Cider Chat Facebook page. And he says that it's been very successful. Of the 12 test batches, they have 3 cuttings from their Wildflower field and garden that yield a great tasting starters that were growing up to the pitchable sized colonies. Ooh, so they're kind of using wildflowers to make these yeast. Really lovely stuff. And then he also sent me some little ideas for some upcoming chats. But if you want to see some photos of what he did to do these little, well, yeast colonies, you want to say, go to the Cider Chat Facebook page. I think they'll be posted already by the time this podcast goes live. If not, they'll be going live this week. Thanks, Jim, for your review and rating on iTunes, and making it a 5-star really made a difference for this podcast. Thanks again, buddy. And, well, good day to your brother in Australia. Well, I'm thinking that this little chat about the Lady Apple and this week's chat with Chuck Shelton is just kind of like right in sync with what we've been going on with the past couple episodes, because Chuck will be discussing a bit about blending cider and single variety cider. Lots of great tips in here, both for commercial and non-commercial cider makers. Really interesting guy. I look forward to meeting him in person. This was pre-recorded via Skype. And just so you know, Chuck is based down in Virginia, where his family has Abermeral Cider Works and Vintage Virginia Apples. So he'll be discussing what goes on there, and I'll be filling in a little bit here and there. I really enjoyed meeting him, even if it was via Skype. And the guy, he's just, you know, one of those kind of treasures. So I didn't have to do too much editing. I just let him roll along, and off we went. So now let's you and I grab a glass and join this chat with Chuck Shelton of Abermeral Cider Works. You know, I was wondering about the pronunciation for Abermeral. It sounds like there's not an R after that first E, but it's kind of a pronunciation of that. It sounds like there's an R. And I don't know if that's kind
of... Could just be my southern accent.
I love that southern accent. It swoons everybody.
Albemarle. I think it's Albemarle. But it often gets an R in there and people misspell it. But there's only one R in Albemarle.
I know. Well, it's a beautiful logo that you folks have, and I know you got some cool stuff going on there. So let's just get right into it. I'd like to give the listeners, like in Siderville, a little bit of an image of where you're at. I know, you know, I've been down in Virginia, and I know you're about 3 hours south of Washington, D.C. How close are you to, like, the Blue Ridge Parkway?
20 miles. 15 probably by air, but 20 miles.
And
to the Skyline Drive and Blue Ridge Parkway.
Yeah, which if folks who don't know about that, that is one heck of a drive right up through, like, the hinterland of Virginia, and just absolutely spectacular. The location's called Rural Ridge Lane. So how rural of an area is it, and how big in, we'd speak in acres for the orchard? How large of an orchard are you dealing with there?
Yeah, just Rural Ridge Lane is, we were looking around for a name for our farm when we bought it. We bought it in 1986. We bought it as a family. My father retired, and my mother, who was living at the time, and they settled here. And then later on, my sister moved back, Charlotte. She's our business leader for this operation. And my brother Bill and my brother Todd, sharing it. Todd is living in Washington working, but Bill comes up on weekends and he's integral in our production and everything we do here. And Charlotte is certainly the financial underpinning for it. So that's kind of how we got here. So we were looking for a name, and there's an old Shelton homestead in Hanover County called Rural Plains. And we said, well, we can't call it that. And it wasn't a plain, so we called it Rural Ridge because it's up here in the mountains, and it's just our driveway name. Orchard-wise, we started planting trees in 1992. Charlotte went to apple tasting at Monticello. We grew up with apples, but not like the ones we're growing. We had wine sap and red and golden delicious and a few other varieties. Grimes golden occasionally. But Charlotte went to this apple tasting with Tom Burford, and he was presenting 50 varieties. So she got a real tasting, and she bought some trees, because Tom had a nursery of a lot of these vintage varieties. So we started planting the orchard in 92 or 3. I went with her the next year to this tasting, and we decided on some more varieties. So we've expanded. We're only growing about 12 acres of apples. It's a pretty small orchard, but it's 250 varieties. So we have a lot of variety in there. And we've expanded the operation to include a nursery. We sell a lot of these tree varieties that we've collected. As vintage Virginia apples. And our farm, we've bought it in different times, but we have 142 acres, I think, that we own. And it's sitting up against a small mountain, Tom Mountain, here in North Garden. And it's kind of rolling hills east of us, and all around us there are little mountains. The bigger mountains are the Blue Ridge, of course. It's 20 miles to the west.
What kind of soil do you have?
Red clay.
Wow, okay.
A lot of red clay with rocks and a lot of quartz in it. And, yeah, it's a rocky red clay, which is actually pretty good for growing apples and grapes. It's probably 35 to 40 vineyards within 20 miles of us. And there's at least 5 cideries here within a 15 to 20 mile radius now. Mm-hmm. So
I know you have this connection with Tom Buford, who's, like, really, you know, kind of renowned for his work with apples. He's, you know, written some books, and, you know, his Apples of North America, Exceptional Varieties for Growers, Gardeners, and Cooks. You know, he's done a lot of work, and I'm wondering, how integral is he to Albemarle Cider Works, where you are now?
Well, he certainly helped get us started by introducing us to a lot of apple varieties, and then out of that, we got involved with Tom. He wasn't part of us, but he does help advise us all the time. He helps conduct our classes that we teach here. He's been a consultant to Monticello. He was doing the apple tasting for Monticello when we first met him. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of strange. He's actually from the same county we were born and grew up in. And we kind of knew who he was or who his family was. We knew about his orchard, but we'd never really met him until 1992, I guess it was. And then out of that has grown, it's a great friendship that we have with him. And he was kind of a pioneer in preserving heirloom apples. Mm-hmm. And so he's definitely known around the country for that. And we take full advantage of our relationship with him. But I would say he's a very, very close family friend now, but he has helped us. He's the one that got us started with apples, which grew into the cider. And he's kind of influenced a lot of other cider makers like Foggy Ridge. He's been contacted by most cider makers at one time or another, asking them about apple tree varieties.
You have quite a variety of apples that you grow there. And I know that you have your own nursery and sell Scion to folks. I think you're maybe not selling that right now in the fall.
We don't sell Scion. We share Scion sometime, but we sell trees, and we actually sell rootstock for people to graft onto. And okay. If it's not too much trouble and we have the Scion, we sometimes share small amounts. But we basically have our collection basically was a big experiment for us and a hobby that grew into this business. And then the nursery is one of the, I call it a 3 or 4 prong business. We have the nursery, we sell fresh fruit here, which we grow a little bit, and then we buy in from certain varieties from local orchards that are not common in grocery store chains. Mm-hmm. And then we do the classes and the cider. So basically it's a 4-prong business. The classes is kind of a small thing. It's really to provide information, and it helps augment our nursery and in some cases our cider business.
What are some of the classes that you hold there? What would be some of the titles for the classes?
So we have 4 main ones. We do pruning with Tom. We do a grafting workshop that Tom helps teach. We do planting and planting a home orchard, and that's usually Tom is involved in that. But last 7, 8, 9 years, Rich Marini, who's used to be with Virginia Tech and is now head of the horticulture program at Penn State, has been coming to teach that for us. And we try to do, we've been doing this for 10 to 12 years, a cider forum, we call it. So a lot of Virginia cider makers have grown up with us and been to our forum. And then some of the people from out of state, they're, you know, you could go to the Peter Mitchell course. I went to the one in Geneva in 2006, and then you can go to the one in Washington State. But there wasn't a lot being done with, you know, kind of educating people about what cider really is. And we usually bring in a guest. We've had Steve Wood come to present one time, Terry Maloney, who unfortunately passed away right after he was here, but he came and did a great one. That's all it is, a one-day forum. And we usually bring in cider and have a big cider tasting at the end of that so people can experience cider from other places. So
that's not really a cider-making workshop. It's a forum where folks are...
Some of it's technical, but a lot of it's more of the qualitative enjoyment of cider and what other people are doing in other places. And maybe out of that, how do you market and who you're marketing to? Kind of an informal workshop. But
well, it sounds like you folks are full on there, no doubt. And I'm wondering about that in terms of all these different divisions that you started. You said you had fruit growing. At what point did your family say, we want to get into cider? And what was the catalyst for that?
You know, all that's kind of nebulous to me right now, but I remember bits and pieces as far back. My youngest brother was actually worked for Senator Leahy from Vermont. Mm-hmm. As an aide. And he was up in Vermont sometime during the 90s. I just remember this. I don't know the exact year. And brought back a couple 6-packs of woodchuck cider. I said, well, hey, you know, this is pretty good. And I would, we were about 3 or 4 years into having apples, and I was starting to make some small batches here and letting it ferment. I got my carboys and everything. And so I produced some stuff that we thought was pretty good. And, you know, the question is, well, can you actually do that and consistently make a product that you can sell to people? So then you had to figure out all that in between. Cider just, I tell people, cider happens. If you squeeze juice out of an apple and put it in a jar, as long as you keep the vinegar bacteria from getting in, you're going to make cider. It's going to make itself. Mm-hmm. You can't stop it unless you freeze it. So I was doing some of that, and we were fortunate to have a cold storage here for apples, so I was able to put it in there when, because I was living in North Carolina and doing this long distance. So I did, I guess, amateur cider for 7-8 years like that. And we hosted a conference here called NAFEX. I don't know if you've heard of that, North American Fruit Explorers. Mm-hmm. It was bigger at one time than it is now, shrunk, and they're trying to grow it back. But we hosted it here in Charlottesville, and there were people that brought cider that they'd made in there, and some of it was, like, not too good, but some of it was interesting. And so we started thinking, you know, well, maybe we can do this. And we went the first, really, I want to say the first recollection I have of tasting what I consider to be top quality cider was in New Hampshire at a NAFEX meeting, and we tasted Farnham Hills cider there for the first time, I think. And so it just kind of grew out of all of that. And I went to Peter Mitchell's cider class at Geneva, mm-hmm. New York, in 2006, my son. And then it was another 2 years before we finally put everything together and started building the thing. And we actually got a license in September of 2008, 8 years ago, I guess. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. And we started producing cider that fall. And we opened our doors of our tasting room in July of 2009. So that's our history here. So.
And you're now making some real single variety ciders, like the Arkansas Black. And thank you very much for sending that along. I mean, that's just a real specific cider apple. What has changed in that 8 year period of time? Has that, like, been from going to a blended cider to now more single varieties, or what have you seen over the past 8 years?
Well, for us, I think we're kind of an outlier in terms of single variety. The rule of general thinking on cider, even Peter Mitchell said, is it needs to be blended. We talk about English ciders. There's only one, it's a Kingston Black, I think, that they would consider making a single variety out of. Some of the single varieties that had, like Terry Maloney, he had more than one apple. And Arkansas Black, to be honest, has 25% Newtown or Albemarle pith in it. We did that because the Arkansas Black, even though it has this great flavors and everything, it was a little low on the acid side, and we wanted to build that, and we had an excess of pippin, and actually married up pretty well, I think. So that's my favorite right now, personally, but and it's doing fairly well everywhere it's presented, in stores or here at our tasting room. So so most ciders you're going to find are blends. One, people don't have access to Arkansas Black like we do. You got to have a lot of a certain apple to do a single variety with it. So people default by putting in blends, and blends are excellent, and you can get a lot of complexities. Our first ciders were all blended. Well, I take that back. Our Royal Pippin is a single variety, mm-hmm. Newtown or Albemarle Pippin. It's the same apple. It's Newtown Pippin, originally from New York, but in this area they call it Albemarle Pippin because it actually was grown probably to a greater extent than it was in New York here back in the 1800s. So, yeah, we had the Albemarle or Newtown or Royal Pippin as our single variety Pippin. And then we had Jupiter's Legacy has about 30 varieties in it. Mm-hmm. I'm not opposed to blending it. And there's great things can happen in blending. And a lot of people thought you had to get really consistent good ciders, you had to have blends. But I had enough pippin juice that I could blend with it and I could try it alone. And it has some wine-like characteristics that are interesting to people. And we're in a big winery anyway, so it's done fairly well here for us. And then we came along with Winesap, which Winesap's been around for 300 years too, and it was used for cider. So we made a Winesap that I thought was, I liked. I've got to admit, it didn't present as well as our others at first, but it's kind of got its own little following. It's a different, it's kind of, some people say earthy, some mineral flavors, but it's got a fruit in it as well. So it's, I still like it. I like the Arkansas Black better, and Arkansas Black was a seedling of Winesap, so it's got some of the characteristics in it. But then we, gosh, we moved on to, we did a Hughes Crab, one of it. We knew that was a cider variety, but that's not readily available. We've only been able to do it once, so we did a single variety Hughes Crab that was well received. Then we went on to, Gold Rush was our next one. Gold Rush is a modern variety.
Mm-hmm.
You never hear of it, hardly. We didn't used to hear of it being mentioned as a cider apple, but we did a single variety cider with it, and it's done really well for us. And I think you're going to see more and more of that being used. Mm. It has a really high acid and kind of a citrusy flavor to it. So we've done that one. And we did Black Twig, which we've sold out of, and that's another apple. It's not that prevalent here or anywhere, so you have to wait till they come along and fall in your lap to do these things. But so I will do varieties, single varieties with apples that will stand up by themselves. And it takes more than just one. You can't have a single characteristic. It's got to have multiple characteristics for it to stand up by itself and present well in a bottle to people. So I've been fortunate enough to come across quantities of these varieties and do that. And so I don't know if I'm influencing anyone by doing it. I just like them. And people, I think it's interesting to people to know that they can taste a single apple. They want to know what's in your cider. Even, I don't know why they want to know, but what's in this? You know, and you tell them, and okay, and they go on and drink it, and they either like it or they don't. But it's, I think there are things in these, and there's a lot more of them out there. I mean, I don't have access to Black Oxford and a lot of Baldwin and stuff that they have in New England or other places. And so I think people can do single varieties. And but certainly the rest of ours are blends of some varieties for some reason. But and you get more complexity. You can build more complexity into the cider by doing that. It's just there's some, I think there's some varieties that will stand up on their own and of interest. One I hope to come out with this year is Harrison. Harrison, probably the best cider apple ever in the United States, in my opinion. And it's mentioned in William Cox is very highly as a single variety, and there's also a blended for blending other apples with. So it's coming back. It was almost extinct. Tom Burford helped identify the ones that we're grafting from now. So that one may come out next year. So
I'm working with a single variety. Ciders, there, you know, with blend, you could kind of like work off of the blend of apples that you have in there. How do you do that with a single variety? Mm-hmm. And what do you have any tips for cider makers out there who are saying, you know, I have this one tree on the property, and maybe it is, you know, one of a Winesap, for instance. Is there anything particular to doing that you found that's unique versus working with the blends? And is it a matter of just your taste going in there? How do you work with that? Because that's kind of unique, as you said.
Well, I didn't actually come up with this, but I've heard it said, and I say it too, that cider is science and art. And the science, you need to know fermentation and what controls it and what you need to do to do a clean fermentation, to have a clean product. When you're done, you need to know what's going on, how to treat the yeast. And as far as the taste of the cider, yeast has some influence, but it's the apple that's going in it. So I think it's, if you taste an apple and it tastes like it's got good characteristics, you know, it's got a lot of astringency to it, you know, that's going to be good. That helps with the mouthfeel. I like the acids in that. So if you got a good acid balance in an apple, a good level of acid, that's what I'm looking for. I don't have a formula for people. If it tastes good, and then you do a ferment of it, and if it tastes good after it's fermented, then you can put it out there, and you can always blend it. But yeah, you got to have enough to do a batch in whatever size vessel you're doing it in. So my problem, I have 580 gallon tanks, and there's my small ones, so I need 10 bins roughly to fill a tank. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to do a half a tank. I want it full or nearly full. Mm-hmm. So that's 200 bushels of apples. So, if you have smaller vessels, like if you're doing a trial batch, you can do it in a carboy of 5 gallons. That's pretty easy to do. But I did a little bit of that early on, and I kind of knew what Pippin would do. I knew what Stamen would do. I had some crab apples that I tested, and I tested Harrison, and so I kind of know what flavors I'm going to get out of stuff. But as far as whether or not you have a variety that's going to produce a single variety of cider, well, they say Kingston Blacks. I've had several really good Kingston Black ciders. It has the acid, and it's got some other characteristics that you have some astringency, you have some tannin in it. Mm-hmm. So you need all of that in fruit. And I don't go measure it. There's not an easy way to test tannin except by taste. So.
Mm-hmm. Are you using a particular yeast that, or are you just going with like the yeast that's actually already present with the apple?
I've done quite a bit of that here on a smaller basis. You know, when I never used a commercial yeast when I was first. I just let it go wild. Some people think that's dangerous. I think in this area, the yeasts are pretty strong and healthy, and I've never really had a bad wild yeast ferment. I've had some of my big tanks go all the way wild. And some people argue, well, you've got some of your other yeasts are lingering around in there. I don't know that, but I use commercial yeast. I use a commercial dry active yeast mm-hmm. for mine. That's the most expedient and easiest thing. And they're primarily the kind that you would ferment. I guess they call them champagne. Mm-hmm. Low temperature ferment, starting at 60 degrees or cooler, 60 degrees Fahrenheit or cooler, is what I use. And they're used in wines as well, but that's what I'm using. And
what about filtering?
I've heard things about yeast and different yeasts, and I really think that the variety of apple is more important than the yeast that you're doing. But anyhow, there are a lot of people probably argue with me over that. But filtering, I do two filters, because I'm not pasteurizing and doing anything to my cider. I do a polishing filter, which is a 5-micron paper filter, mm-hmm. After the ferment. Just before I have to lay up out a tank, and I use bag and boxes for that. But so I'll do a 5-micron filter and beef up the sulfate in it, and then let it sit till I can put it back in a tank and blend it or bottle it, whichever I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And then my final filter is it's a dual filter. You have to have two filters in line because I'm using a membrane 0.45 absolute filter to get my sterility, quote unquote. It's not really sterile, but it's supposed to take yeast out so that you don't have any yeast in your final product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, how about the brut that you have? And I'm looking at this bottle right in front of me. It says on the bottom, Sparkling Virginia Apple Cider, and you're calling it Brut d'Albemarle. a sardebouche. So this is has a cork in it and covered by a wire. I think it's the only cider that you have like that. Can you talk to us a little bit about that one and sure. If there's anything particular on working with that this, kind of style?
This particular bottle is single variety, Albemarle Pippin. Like I said, we have a bunch of winemakers nearby, and one of them, Zach Serio, champagne maker, who's French, but he does a lot of sparkling wines for people, and he does his own champagne. You can't really call it that, but he probably could because he's from France, but he does a champagne here, and out of Chardonnay mainly, I think, but he came to me and said, hey, would you like me to try to do some? So he did a test batch a couple years ago, and he did it for us. We gave him the juice, and he fermented it, and he did all the disgorging and everything secondary in the bottle. Mm-hmm. And we thought it was really good. And so he asked if we want to do it again. We did a bigger batch. We did this. We're kind of we had to kind of jerry-rig and modify our equipment because we're set up to do we're carbonated. Mm-hmm. We carbonate ours after they're fermented, they've gone completely still. We add carbonation, force carbonation in our carb tank, we call it. Mm-hmm. And we bottle out of that through a counterpressure filler. So we had to rig up and do this bottling on this one through our tank. Wasn't pressurized, but we were running through our counterpressure filler. And then we had put a yeast culture in it, and we bottled it here and then let it sit for 5 months. Claude Thibault, who's the champagne maker I was referring to, took it, and with his equipment, he disgorged and corked it for us. So, and that's, any cider maker probably knows what's bottle conditioned or secondary method champagne loss. Is. That's what this is. Say champagne.
Let's just slow down a little bit because we have a lot of different folks listening to this who are cider makers. Can you explain that just for the folks who are trying to catch up and get a sense of what that is?
What is that? The method champagne law?
Yes, please.
Or go
ahead.
You take a fermented cider or wine and you after you put it in a bottle with a, you have to have a culture of some sort. This year I'm trying a little different. I'm using encapsulated yeast, which if you're a champagne maker or some cider makers probably know about them, but I'm giving that a try. This one I actually used DV10 yeast, which is what a lot of champagne makers use, I think, and we had to build a culture and add it. First we had to add a bunch of sugar back because you add enough sugar to get the 4 atmospheres of pressure in your bottle. And then after you get that in there, you add in this yeast culture, you keep it all stirred up, and then you put it in the bottle and you cap it just with a crown cap. Mm-hmm. And it's just lay it down on the side over 3, 4, 5 months. It ferments out the sugar that you put back in there, and you have a naturally carbonated wine or cider. And then to disgorge it, normally you have to riddle. Actually, ours cleared up pretty well without riddling. Riddling is where you roll the bottle around upside down, get the yeast that's created during the secondary fermentation and get it down in the neck, and then you freeze the neck. And when you open that crown cap, the force of the CO2 that's in that bottle pushes the ice plug that's formed when you freeze it up, and the yeast is stuck on the top, and they slice it off, and they put a cork in it, and you have a clean carbonated cider that's fermented. It's carbonated naturally. The bubbles are smaller. The mouth feels a little different. Mm-hmm. I haven't tasted it in a while. I'm going to taste it right now.
All right. And Chuck, how are you freezing the bottle? I want to make sure that folks aren't thinking that they're going to, like, do the whole bottle there, you know, freezing.
No. One, I got to say, I'm not a champagne maker, so I just know about this. But historically, they use saltwater baths, I think. And I don't know how long it took to freeze. Salt takes the temperature down, and they're even colder, so it freezes faster. And then I'm not sure what the solution is. Mm-hmm. They invert this bottle in this solution. It's a bath. And then when it goes around, within about 5 minutes, the neck is frozen down about 2 or 3 inches.
But they're just putting in the neck, not the whole bottle. Is that correct?
Well, the bottle's inverted, is upside down, because you don't want to drop the yeast back out of the neck. In fact, the yeast already down in there after it's riddled. Mm-hmm. So the yeast is sitting down on the crown cap. Actually, there's a plastic insert they use now that helps aid disgorgement, they call it. Mm-hmm. So all the yeast is falling down in there, and then they freeze this ice plug behind it. Of course, it's under pressure, and when they pop the cork, the pressure wants to go out, so it shoves this ice plug up partially, and they whack it off, and then they immediately send it over and cork it. And in some cases, you have to add a dosage back or something. I don't think they had to do that there. They just disgorged it and immediately corked and put the crown on it.
So what do you think about making like this other a level of the champagne kind of method, or, you know, what folks are calling like a sparkling cider in that way, or the cider bouche? Mm-hmm. I think that's a great term too, which means like a corked cider.
I know some cider makers are doing it. Eve's in New York, I think, did all of hers that way. I gotta say, it takes a lot more work and time, because basically you take cider that you would have normally bottled and sold after 9 months or a year, and then you're adding another year to the process. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of equipment involved. You can do stuff by hand. There's ways of doing it, but it's tedious. And if you pay someone like Claude to do it, that's another expense on top of this. So the product is, you have to sell it for more. Mm-hmm. You use a heavier bottle because it is under 4 atmospheres of pressure. I would say it's going to be a limited product for us, but we are continuing, or we have the capability of doing it now, and enough knowledge, especially if this encapsulated yeast works out for us, because that basically riddles itself in about 12 seconds when you turn it upside down.
That's amazing.
I've watched. It's like little marbles rolling down from the neck. And so with the normal yeast, will adhere the bottle, and you got to shake it and roll it around to get them to fall down in there. So there's probably a little bit of yeast in some of our bottles because he didn't riddle it. Mm. And we just turned it upside down for about a month before he got it. We had enough of it settled down that he got most of it out. So some of ours have a slight cloud in the bottom, but a lot of it's totally clear, so it basically riddled itself just by turning it upside down with no agitation. But riddling is I don't know how long it takes. It can take a week or more on one of the machines they have. They used to say that in France, I mean, it took months because they went around and they turned the bottle where you spin the bottle to make the yeast fall down in the neck, and then they would do the disgorgement. But so you've about exhausted my knowledge of
I'm wondering,
champagne making.
With this whole Cider Act that's coming in effect in the U.S. in 2017, where carbonation, you know, can be increased, you know, certainly this method that
this won't affect
will it affect your cider?
Not really. I don't have the capability to go any higher in pressure when I'm force carbonating. Mm-hmm. So I'll probably keep it where I'm comfortable with the level. Like in the Arkansas Black, it's around 1 atmosphere. It's made to be at the level it was allowed before. The Brut, which is 4 atmospheres, is just and the, by the way it's produced, it's taxed at $3.40 a gallon versus 17 cents a gallon. So we just have to add that into the price. That's another thing that drives the price of champagne up, is the sin tax on champagne. It's and there's no way around that. So anybody that's making a naturally carbonated cider is having to pay that tax.
Right. Well, that
and you as a consumer are going to pay it as well.
Right, exactly. Now, the Brut that we're talking about, that's, I think I'm seeing like a 9.5% alcohol by volume. So that's kind of definitely kicking it over that level and for taxation. And then the Arkansas Black that's in my hand here is a 7.8%. So you're getting some, you know, high ABVs there. What do you see as a, and especially coming in this year with the drought, what are you seeing for like your sugar level and your ABV? What's your standard?
Our lowest cider ever, I think, is 7% or 6.98. And we've been up to 10. Eight to somewhere between 8 and 10 is common for apples here in Virginia. Arkansas Black tends to be a little bit lower in sugar. The Pippin actually probably drove that up, but Arkansas Black is, what was it, 7.2 or something? It's going to, it's been up to 8. It might get up to 8 in a real dry year. Apples like Gold Rush, typically the one we just bottled is 9.9. Pippin often is in the 8.5 to 9.5 range. The Pippin that was used as a base for the Brut is 9, and just the the additional sugar we added drove it up another 0.5% when we did the secondary in the bottle. So that's where the 9.5 for that came from. So, but we're south. This typical of the south, our apples are going to get a higher sugar level than they are further north. So actually, if you did this in New York, you're probably going to see a percent lower for the same apple. So
right,
there is seasonal variability, and there's variability among apples. So something like our Hughes Crab is almost 20 bricks, so it's going to always go up to 10%.
I know some folks.
Harrison is going to be high.
Some people listening to this are like, you know, they can't even imagine that those levels in some different spots around the world. I'm wondering, talking about sugar, how much is sugar added into your ciders across the board? Is there much tepalization there?
No. The only thing that's considered tepalization was in the Brut. Like I said, we had to add enough to get 4 atmospheres, and it drove it up 0.5%. Technically, according to the state of Virginia, that's tepalization. And so we had no sugar pre-fermentation. We back sweetened 3 varieties. We do our Royal Pippin just to cut the acidity, 0.2%. We have 2 blends that we do. One is 0.7 and one is 2%. And that's just to provide a more breadth to our offering. There are people, a lot of people like sweet ciders. I'm not one of them, so I'm not prone to do that. Although our sweetest one typically is our best seller because it appeals to a much broader taste range.
Which one is that, dear Chuck? The sweet one.
I'm sorry, which one is the sweetest?
Yeah.
It's called Plum Mary. First year was all Pippin because we had a lot of Pippin juice that year, and we looking to do another product, so we made it 2%. And since then, it's been a blend, but it's always been 2%. We add enough sugar to get 2%, 20 grams per liter, and that's kind of our formula for that one. And like I said, it's probably the best seller, but if you look at all of our dry ciders, they're selling like equal.
That's
so
great.
We're in a pretty good market for wine, and you know, not everywhere is like that. I've talked to cider makers, some other, and they think, you know, they're restricted by, well, they are. They're restricted by their clientele. So if they're in an area where there's not a lot of wine drinking going on. So we're fortunate. We have a lot of wine traffic through the area, and we have a lot of craft brewers here. And craft brewers are into all kinds of stuff, and they kind of like the dry ciders. And so we have outlet for both dry and sweet ciders here. But there's plenty of sweeter products out there. We just choose to keep ours where it is.
So. Right. Now, Chuck, do you have to explain cider to people? And if you are in that position when people are asking, well, what is cider? How do you explain that?
Because of Prohibition, there was a wide gap when there was no fermented cider. So fresh juice became cider. And so, yeah, people come in and think, oh, is this alcoholic? And, well, yeah. But we're cordial to people. We understand that they may be coming from a background we've never tasted, and they may not like it. And we do sell fresh juice here as well. We do a certain amount, a couple thousand gallons a year of fresh juice, and we sell it to people. We let them taste it at the end of the tasting. We wouldn't give it to them up front because we're real dry, and then fresh cider here is, you know, 15% sugar. So so we do have that available, and the kids get to drink it and have a good time too. So it's kind of, we're kind of a multifaceted in that way. But usually if I'm, I don't do this often, they don't let me behind the bar up there, but I'll ask someone, have you had cider before? What do you know? Like, do you even know what you're asking for here? And then I try to explain to them, well, this is what cider is. And cider is not that sweet juice that you think it is. Cider is a fermented product. You go to Europe and you're going to get, you ask for a cider, you're going to get something that's alcoholic. If you want juice, you better ask for juice. That's what they call it over there in their own language. But so cider, and probably in this country, cider early on was the fermented product, and it's just gotten convoluted in all the shenanigans we did with Prohibition and everything. So the only juice that you could get was unfermented cider legally. I'm sure people had it, but they didn't. And they call it all cider. But Termelani made a point of saying he didn't like the word hard on his, and he wouldn't put on his bottle, and neither do we. I would say cider.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to change people's perception of what cider is.
I would like to thank Chuck Shelton of Albemarle Cider Works and Vintage Virginia Apples. A lot going on down there, and this guy, he just had so many like fun little, well, kind of like sound bites. You know, one was just that cider happens. If you squeeze juice out of an apple and put it in a jar, as long as you keep the vinegar bacteria out, you're going to make cider, and it's going to make itself. You can't stop it unless you freeze it. Love that. And also those tidbits about blending and single variety. And I think folks don't really know or had realized that sometimes it says a single variety on the label, but there is a base cider too working behind that. And partly that's because to make a single variety apple cider, you have to have enough apples. And many orchards at this point do not have enough to make that single variety. So they're going to kind of be beefing it up, even at a cidery like Albemarle that has 250 varieties. Hooey, that's a whole bunch of apple varieties to be maintaining. I really hope to make it down there at some point, because I'd like to see that orchard and see how they're kind of managing that whole scene. Because there's got to be a kind of a checks and balances to so many apple trees. So thanks a lot, Chuck. Can't wait to meet you. And again, thanks for sending along that cider so I could get a sense of what you're making. It sure helps. And all the best to the folks and the family down there. I would would like to thank the patrons of this podcast. And you too can become a patron too and help keep this chat thriving. If everyone in Ciderville just signed up to donate $1 a month, it would really make a big difference moving forward. So please consider that by going to the Cider Chat Patreon page. It's easy to do and it means so much. And if you do like this podcast, then I want to recommend that you support the cideries that support this chat. That is A Current Cider in Percocet, Pennsylvania, Big Apple Hard Cider of New York City, and a tip of the glass to Oliver's Cider and Perry, that is a Tom Oliver in Hertfordshire in the UK. Thank you so much. Well, it's time to roll out of here, Ciderville, and say adieu. If you'd like to get the show notes and see some photos of Chuck Shelton and his siblings and some of the bottles that you might be able to be lucky enough to get, go to episode number 56. There's also links there on ciderchat.com to the YouTube channel and to Cider Chat's Patreon page. In the meanwhile, I'm getting ready for Eric Bordelais next week. I can't wait to bring that one and so many more podcasts to you. In the meantime, be well and may your cup always be at least half full. This is Rio and Caller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!